Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello. Oh, boy, are you ready for a book that will literally keep you on the edge of your seat and also makes you think about something you may or may not have any experience with, and I have to plead total ignorance and or experience with. What? Chess. Yes. The book is called Spy's Mate. Now, it is a novel. Brad Buchanan is my guest, but let me tell you, this is a story that has so much truth in it regarding the game of chess, but international intrigue that goes side by side with it. Truth, fiction. You'd be the one that would have to decide. Brad Buchanan, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Donna. What a lovely introduction.
Well, I'll tell you what, by the time I finished reading your book, I thought, goodness gracious, for someone who is as ignorant as anybody could be about the game of chess, I absolutely love the way a chessboard looks. Like, I have seen the most magnificent chess sets that I wonder why anybody even wants to play with them. They're so beautifully designed. But my goodness, it is an awareness that you bring through this book, how the game of chess is so vitally important internationally. And I happened to see something about some players that just not that long ago, and I was astonished. I was looking at young kids playing chess, and they're, you know, moving these pieces. They're bonging the timer on the side of wherever they're sitting, and it's bing, 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 bing. And I'm watching these kids, and I'm saying, I'm sure glad they know what they're doing because I haven't a clue. This is an amazing book, Brett. You have done an incredible job with it. It's complex. Now, you yourself, you are really an avid writer. You have degrees in English literature from various environments, mm-hmm. Stanford University, University of Toronto, McGill University. You've done academic books, and you also have written a medical memoir about your own personal experience with fighting cancer. But this, I mean, you've even got the layouts of the chessboards throughout the book. It is so intriguing. Yeah. What made you come up with this concept? Are you a chess fanatic?
Well, yeah, I think fanatic is probably about the right word. Because of my various illnesses, I've had to stop playing sports. I used to play hockey, used to play soccer, go for long runs. But my body just won't put up with that type of punishment any longer. So I had this sort of chess obsession in my background. My mother taught me to play when I was little, just like Yasha, the hero's mother, teaches him to play in the novel. And when I realized I was not going to be able to play those games any longer, I really started to focus on chess and started playing a lot more with my friends, started playing online. And a friend of mine started playing and talking about writing a chess book, but we couldn't agree about what kind of book we wanted to write. Writers are notoriously bad at collaborating with each other, so I just decided to go off and write my own chess story, a chess story that I would have wanted to read. Mm-hmm. That didn't exist in the real world, a work of fiction that does draw on quite a bit of historical fact. I've added bits and pieces here and there, but I did a lot of research to establish the fact that the KGB, the Soviet spy agency, was very heavily involved in elite chess during the last days of the USSR, in particular when chess was used as a propaganda tool. Basically, mm-hmm. the Russians wanted to show that they were supreme at this game that values intelligence as though that would prove the superiority of communism to capitalism. The Russians were willing to, pull all kinds of dirty tricks, spying on their own, top players, rewarding loyal communists and sort of ostracizing, marginalizing players who might have been better, but who were not, politically correct in their world, or who wanted to emigrate to different countries. Those grandmasters were, treated as less than, and sometimes really badly treated, persecuted, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of that makes its way into Spiesmate in various ways.
Well, I was fascinated by your two quotes that you give right at the beginning. One is, chess is a war over the board. The object is to crush the opponent's mind. That's Bobby Fischer, who was a grandmaster, I believe. And again, I don't know anything about the game. I just remember that there was quite a bit of press that went to Bobby Fischer, and he had a lot of issues because of the game itself, because you have to literally immerse yourself in it, mind, body, soul, for whatever time it takes, and it is highly, highly competitive. And then H.G. Wells said, there's no remorse like the remorse of chess. And I thought of I thought of Bobby Fischer, too, when I was thinking that, because he had a lot of very, very intense personal issues, too, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, yeah. He went crazy, not to put too fine a point on it. He became very paranoid. He was a conspiracy theorist. But, by the way, one of his conspiracy claims was that the Soviets were conspiring against him. And about that, he was correct.
Mm-hmm. Right?
There's definitely evidence to support that. But his other conspiracy theories, I don't subscribe to. But he was very passionately devoted to chess, single-minded. He sort of put chess on the map in some ways in the United States, especially in the last part of the 20th century, by winning the World Chess Championship against a Russian, against a Soviet grandmaster, in 1972, but then he sort of refused to defend his title and went into hiding, thought everyone was trying to, poison him or something or other, and just kind of lost his marbles. And there was actually a Bobby Fischer-esque character in Spiesmate, but I will let readers discover who that might be, although there are certainly some important differences. But chess players are highly intelligent, of course, in that one sphere of life. But in all their other dealings, they are ordinary humans, just like the rest of us, with all kinds of failings and blind spots and weak spots where they can be manipulated or exploited or whatnot. So I'm really fascinated, by the game itself, of course, but by the very flawed human beings who play the game at high levels.
Well, if you think about the concentration that it takes and the discipline, if you orient all of your energies just towards that one factor, that is all encompassing. I mean, anything and everything else is a distraction. And if you're going to be at the top, you're not unlike someone that's training for the Olympics. You have to make that your core. If it's not your core, you don't have a chance. Because
you're absolutely right about that.
Yeah, you just are too easily distracted or distorted. And this is something your primary character, Yasha, Basmajian. And this takes place, interestingly enough, in the Socialist Republic of Armenia, which is, which was part of the Soviet Union. And Armenians have a tremendous historical background anyway, and I'm familiar with that because of associations I've had through marriage in the past with the Armenian people, and it's quite a profound experience to know their history. And this you bring out also in the book. But Yasha, you started off in the book because his mother is extremely ill. She has a terminal disease. And like you said, his mom, just like your mom did in the story here, his mother has taught him chess. And there is an unknown factor that he doesn't learn about until he enters into the game of chess regarding a member of family who actually was a chess champion. So he comes by this knowledge or this capability genetically to a degree. And his mother just says that, you know, this is what I would like for you to do to become a world champion. And because she ends up being in the hospital, then there is a commitment that he makes to her that he will be a world champion, that she'll live to see him, because he finally finds out she's got a terminal disease. She will live to see him, to know that he has become the world champion. And that is a very powerful beginning in your book that makes you realize that sometimes people do things or become immersed in something because of someone that they love, that they want to be able, because they have an acumen for it, whatever that might be, that they want that loved one to know that they will achieve what they're going to achieve. So that's part of his drive, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely, yeah, and it's a very rash promise, you know, that he sort of forces her to make, and in some ways it becomes something that he is promising her too, you know, that they have this pact that she will survive long enough to see him win the world chess champion. And when he makes that promise, he's really still very much an outsider in the chess world. He's just kind of learned the game, and he's just starting up, but he has an affinity with the pieces, and he can already tell that he's going to be obsessed with the game. But yeah, that's really the emotional core of the book. And I don't want to spoil the ending, but I will just say that Yasha gets to have a moment with his mother at the end of the book that I did not get with my own mother when she passed away. Also of, you know, a slow but kind of inevitable illness in late 2021. And so in a way I wrote the book kind of as a tribute to her.
Mm-hmm.
And I will not shy away from admitting that as I wrote the final pages of Spider-Man, I was weeping to myself, just sort of wishing that I had had the same you know, connection and in those last moments of my mother's life that Yasha has with his mother, even though she's barely conscious of what's going on. That really is the emotional core of the book, and everything else is, to some extent, stuff to tease your brain, you know, with lots of different characters, lots of chess diagrams, and, you know, I'm really gratified that as someone, you know, who is not terribly familiar with the game, you could follow it through the diagrams. And there's also sort of reminders at the end of the book of, like, here's what the pieces are called and here's how they move and so forth. And you don't have to be a chess nerd to enjoy the book. And I'm really grateful for you reaffirming that for your listeners.
Well, the illustrations that you have of the chessboards is very intriguing. You know, you have all of the chess pieces, and you have them in the different positionings as you're describing them. So it is something that with the visual, along with the written word, even though a lot of it doesn't make any sense to me, at the end of your book, you also explain what each square represents. And so that's something people can go and, you know, flip to that back section if they want to as they're reading it. But you really went into a lot of the history that was actually occurring. And when I was reading it, and I don't see you stating it specifically, and I ask you before we started our conversation this evening, before going on air, was this about the 1980s in that time genre? And you said yes, it was about that time frame. And the Russians, Even today, they are notorious. The political environments of Russia, they are notorious for lying. And I say that, I am saying that, and it's absolutely a fact. You can read all the information about whoever is saying what, and then the next day or within maybe hours, you find out, oh, guess what? They lied. They're not doing X, Y, Z. So it's a part of the, what I want to say, the political environment that is there. And you have in the beginning of the book, you explain about a guy called Autumn Livoni Rotskoy. And he was known, as I'm using your words, an infamous dandy known to his few friends and many enemies as an absurdly ambitious KGB operative, a kind of Marxist James Bond. Wow. That sentence right there gets, you know, gets intrigues you. But this is real. This is the KGB, and there were other names for it before it became the KGB. It is the SS, if you will, of the Russian political environment. Some people may think that's a little brave of me to say, but they're just as brutal. And this is something where the political agitation that you bring out. Now, you use different names, but right. You are using the same kind of flow of dynamics that was written about. And it was both on the Russian side that it was written about, as well as on the international side. And it's not a joke. It's really, it's very, very real. And to find that it is integrated into an international competition, well, my goodness, historically, it was known about the Russian sports activity in the link in the Olympics. And that is a fact. That's not made up. And there's all of this history that even though the country was more like a third world country during that time frame and even before, they put up a false front. But my goodness, what they would do to their top performers, no matter what area of sports or international competition they might be in, it was the same thing. They didn't hesitate to take people out, and I mean figuratively and literally, take them out if they didn't meet the criteria that they were supposed to meet. And there were many people interviewed that defected that talked about this very, very thing, that you had to reach the high standards. And in many instances for many years, whether it was sports or anything else, they were the best. They were just put under the gun big time.
Absolutely, yeah, and that, you know, that's why I talk about the games of chess that Yasha plays as the true life or death games. You know, it's not just chess today. When people are playing at the highest level, it's really just about money and fame and so forth. And they certainly want to win, but Yasha sort of has to win, otherwise his life is going to be in ruins. And if not, there's one grandmaster who is, in fact, killed by the KGB in the book. I won't give away who. It's not an exaggeration to say that the chess games in the novel are indeed matters of existential, survival or not.
And he's so naive. He was shown certainly. Yasha was so talented. Young, he's winning championships when he's very, very young. He doesn't have any real, what I want to say, top-notch coaches. That comes later. And that in and of itself is very interesting. And his family history is very interesting. But he is so devoted to his mother that is, she's everything in his world. And there's a good reason for that. So all of that, it's quite a dynamic book. Now, you talk about a competition in Helsinki, Finland, and these chess tournaments, they take place all over the world, don't they?
Absolutely. Yeah, chess is a global game, per se.
With that global game, I don't know who the latest chess master is, but I know you bring up something here which was in development in the 1980s, and that is a computer playing chess. Now, human beings have to put that together. Who's the latest world champion? Is it an Asian gentleman? I believe I saw a program on that about three or four months ago.
Well, he's an Indian, I think he's still a teenager, Gukesh Domaraju is his name. He is a fairly newly minted champion. He took over from a Chinese player named Ding Li Ren, who succeeded Magnus Carlsen, who is still regarded as the greatest chess player alive. But Magnus Carlsen was tired of defending his classical chess champion title and prefers to focus on shorter time controls where the games, you know, don't take 6 to 7 hours to complete and where he doesn't have to, you know, study too hard in advance. Mm-hmm. Because he's proven all he needs to prove in his chess life. Magnus Carlsen is considered either the greatest chess player of all time or roughly tied with Garry Kasparov, who is the chess champion upon whose life I roughly modeled Yasha's development. Like Yasha, Garry is not sort of an ethnic Russian. Garry was a mixture of, I think, Armenian and Jewish, and he grew up in, I think, Baku in Azerbaijan. So he was an outsider, and he was not really welcomed into the Soviet chess establishment in the way that his antagonist Anatoly Karpov was, because Karpov was a loyal communist, whereas Kasparov was a free thinker, basically a very independent spirit, and also Karpov was a Slavic, he was Russian through and through. And so, of course, the Soviet elites would have much preferred that Karpov, the main champion, but Kasparov happened to be a much stronger player, so he ended up winning and retaining the championship for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, since Kasparov, there's been a number of different world chess champions, but yeah, Magnus Carlsen is regarded as the greatest living player, even though he's not technically the world chess champion any longer.
I remember watching that video on the Asian gentleman that you mentioned, the name you mentioned, and he was playing against a computer. And that, to me, and he, I think he actually won a game or two against the computer, but after that, he didn't. So it was really challenging, and that's something you bring out in this story about how Yasha did not want to play with a computer. And I found it intriguing that he didn't want to look. At that time, they put it up on a screen. Well, they had the game set up so that someone else, and this was a female player, and women were not given the opportunity to compete to the degree that the men were. And she was, I think her name was Katie, and she was really good. So he was comfortable with Katie.
Yep.
Doing the moves off of, but eventually they just said, you have to get somebody else that's just totally out of the picture because he does not like, you know, playing against the computer at all. It's not human.
Yes, exactly. And you know, in that period of time, computers were still not as good at chess as the highest level grandmasters were. But today, of course, computers have completely blown past all human players as far as their understanding of the deeper kind of strategies and tactics of chess. So computers have come a long way since the time frame that I'm writing about in SpiesMate. But they were still getting experimented with, and it is true that, as I say in the novel, the Russians were well behind the West in developing chess computers and had to kind of steal, to some extent, from the West to create computers almost of any type because their technological innovation was light years behind, despite what they would have liked to have claimed. That the West is just evolving much faster technologically than the Soviets were.
Well, that is something. The Chinese have done that with U.S. technology. I mean, this is something the Japanese, during World War I, the Germans did their stuff. And, you know, World War II, we had, after World War II, we had the Japanese, we had the Chinese. We had so many people that were trying to steal technologies. And this espionage, if you will, is still going on today. And the United States wanted to find out. That's how we were able to succeed with a lot of what we succeeded with in World War II, because we had those people that were doing the same thing to the countries that were doing it to us. So, you know, the game goes on even today. And
yeah.
Because I was unfamiliar with chess, vaguely, a bit knowledgeable about it, but I wouldn't even give myself, 1% of knowledge as far as it goes. However, what we were talking about, again, before the show started, is that this is really a game that increases an awareness of looking at options. What options do we have? It's a strategist game. Mm-hmm. And like I said just a few days ago, I was watching children playing a game of chess. One youngster, he couldn't have been more than 8 or 9 years of age, and he was playing against a young adult. And he just, the brain was working at such a speed, and he looked like he was so bored in between moves. And I just said, my goodness, what this brings into the psyche is that level of concentration, focus, strategical observation. This Absolutely. Is something that is quite incredible. And when I think of the movie about the Asian world champion playing against the computer, the place was filled with camera people and people around the world that were just watching. Millions were watching this world championship. And again, all over the world, people are fascinated with this, absolutely fascinated with it. We have people in parks playing chess, in certain environments. When you were going through this, how did you keep all of this in your head where you could put down all of these moves?
Well, I think the best way is just to learn a few basic chess principles. You want to get your pieces out from the back row, and have them enter the game, and you want to achieve a certain, if you can master the center of the board, that's always good. You want to castle, in other words, get your king out of harm's way as soon as possible. And, a lot can flow from those few basic chess principles. But yeah, it really is a strategy game. I think it's a wonderful game to teach the kids because it gives them a sense of, if you plan carefully and think ahead, you can accomplish a lot. As I get older, I really value brain health. Part of what I had to deal with in my cancer treatments was chemo brain, right, where you have chemotherapy that does kind of temporarily, unfortunately in my case anyway, it slows you down mentally quite a bit. I found, I could sort of fool the tests that were asking me questions because I have a pretty good vocabulary. I'm a word guy. But chess exercises a different area of my brain that words don't, touch really. And so as I get older, playing chess enables me to sort of, I think, maintain a higher level of brain health than I otherwise would. So I think clearly kids take to it and can learn a great deal from it. But I think it's also a game that can last a lifetime, which is really a gift.
Well, I think so. And, of course, the strategies that go into it. There's a lot of memorization that goes with it, too. And that is something that you bring out. You bring out so many aspects of the game itself, along with the dialogues and the sabotaging situations that go on the part of players, because some of them have such huge egos that it's actually, you wonder how anybody could get away with, like, the character rudeness that you portray in here of a few individuals. And you think, why is this permitted? I mean, this is not good sportsmanship. Why is that done? And I think it's all to the drama of the game. Yeah, all absolutely. To the drama. And audiences really get caught up in it. And it's sort of like a soap opera. It's like, well, let's see what the next sequel is like. And even though you may know it, but it's really intriguing, but your information also about what was going on in Russia during the time frame mentioned earlier, it was a very dynamic, conspiratorial type of an environment and terror was reigning strong. There were outbreaks. There were all kinds of things going on in other countries as well, of people like China, the Tiananmen Square, and different things that were happening.
Absolutely.
You know, these are things that your book brings forth in a way and manner that brings a recall of this being very, very much a reality that people were having to deal with, and they actually are having to deal with it even today, big time. And
yeah,
it's
thank you.
Mm-hmm.
That is great to hear. Yeah, I mean, you know, basically what the historical, just to explain to listeners, basically that what's going on in the Soviet Union, in my book, is the old USSR is slowly dying. And there's a Mikhail Gorbachev-style character who comes in promising big changes because everyone is tired of the same old Russian, you know, Soviet system. They want more freedoms. They want more political freedom. They want to be able to buy decent groceries. They want their economy to start working better. And so he makes all these promises that ultimately are really hard to keep. And so he creates this kind of demand for immediate and sustained change in the country. And Yasha is kind of seen in some ways as bringing the same breath of fresh air to the stale world of elite chess in the Soviet Union. And they're actually both, at one point in the novel, they're each kind of under arrest. Yasha's been detained at the airport, and the Gorbachev character is under house arrest because someone is attempting a coup against him, which indeed happened in real life, and the coup, of course, failed. But yeah, there was a lot of turmoil, and it was a very interesting time that I remember vividly as a teenager. You know, I was born in the 70s, and I grew up watching the Soviet Union from afar, fascinated and terrified by this country that, you know, was our enemy, but then just started to crumble in front of our eyes, and we all wondered what is going to happen next. So the novel takes place in that time of social change and dynamic, but also really dangerous political energy getting unleashed, and a lot of violence, especially in the outer republics,
yes,
you know, where people started attacking each other once the Big Red Army decided not to keep the peace any longer. Old ethnic rivalries could rear their ugly heads, and as they do in the novel. So yeah, it was a very rich historical background on which to tell my little chess hero's journey, you know, through the lens of Yasha's life.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and you have, and I've got your book in front of me. One of the Russians saying, the peasant classes cannot cope with too many choices. And I speak as the son of a farmer. What do we want with a dozen brands of laundry detergent, for instance, when one will do for everyone? Do you know, I actually heard someone that was from Estonia. And this was a number of years ago. Now, she would go to visit her family in Estonia. She was born and raised there. And she was smuggled out along with her family out of Estonia to escape the Russian invasion because they knew the brutality of the Russian soldiers. It was well known. It was horrible. And this is something, she would smuggle medical supplies into Estonia because the dentists didn't even have Novocaine or anything like this. They had nothing to do fillings with. And she would smuggle it in. She knew how to bribe the right people in the right places, and it went right into Estonia, and she would get the message back via the smuggling underground that they were very grateful because they had nothing in their environment. And I know that was even the case in the 1990s. I know because I was over there then. And I've known people that were living there as Americans in the military, et cetera. And when I had the opportunity to meet with them and talk with them, they said the same thing. So there is so much that your book brings out. And then you have a paragraph that was very meaningful to me. Freedom holds more dangers than opportunities for us. We need to keep our Soviet institutions strong and our armies well provided for. Otherwise, the republics will splinter and turn against us, and Russia will be back too in a corner. And this is because of the politicians. This is the vie for power. And there is so much of that that's still going on even today. And there's other points of the book that where, you know, that you have that prophetic evolvement that the Russian people are experiencing today, the Ukrainians are experiencing, and who knows how long it's going to go on. It's just, it's one of those things we honestly don't know. Your book is really a powerful read, and it is one, at least for me, that I think is extraordinarily interesting. You want to know what's coming with the next page. Now, Bradley Buchanan, you have your website, and I'm going to give it, and if I don't give it correctly, let me know. It's Brad the Canera, and that's C like Charlie, H-I-N like Nelly, E-R-A. So Brad, B-R-A-D, T-H-E, C-H-I-N-E-R-A.com. This is an amazing publication. And you've got a sequel that you're working on right now to this. My goodness.
Right. Well, and I should mention that people can order Spiesmate right now on Amazon.com. Or if they prefer to avoid Amazon, you can order it to bookshop.org, and that'll be delivered to your local bookstore. So it is available for pre-ordering right now.
And the cover is fabulous. Whoever did the design of the cover did an incredibly good job. What's the symbol that's in the middle of the eye of the square?
Right, the hammer and sickle, yeah. I was like, I thought, shouldn't we put the hammer and sickle, like, you know, in a more obvious place? And he's like, no, people will find it and they'll be intrigued.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was right. No, I'm absolutely delighted with how the book came out, how the diagrams came out. The look and the feel of the book is beautiful. I'm really glad you have a copy there, because I think that's a big part of the, you know, of the appeal of having this kind of book is that people can leaf through it. It's got heft, but it's also fun to look at and to leaf through. And I think the publisher has done a wonderful job of putting it all together, and I'm really grateful to him and to all the chess experts who helped me make sure that the diagrams were correct.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't know of any other novels that have so many chess diagrams in them to illustrate the positions. I don't think there are any, as a matter of fact. And I wasn't even sure it could be done, but
they managed to pull it off.
And I think it's hearing you talk about it, I'm so pleased that you enjoyed it. It suggests to me that, the chess comes through loud and clear, even if you don't come, you know, bearing a whole lot of expertise when you start reading the book.
Well, believe me, you have a little bit by the time you're finished. It is amazing. I'm so delighted that we've had this conversation. And when you do come out with your next one, please let me know. Because I just think that what you've done here is exceptionally brilliant in many, many ways and extremely, extremely intriguing as a read. It's a great way to go into fall and to have something on the bedside table, but I'd recommend you don't read it before you go to bed because you may not be able to go to sleep. Brad, your website again is Brad the Canera, and that's C-H-I-N-E-R-A. I wish you nothing but the best.
Thank you. Chimera is actually spelled C-H-I-M as in man.
M as in man, E-R-A. Thank you for correcting me.
That is right. But if people want the book, they should go to either Amazon.com or bookshop.org.
That's wonderful. That is something they can do. You take care now and get busy with your writing. Don't take 2 years. Maybe you can get it sooner than that.
we'll see. My publisher really wants me to, you know, follow through on the marketing and publicity for Spiesmate first, because you sunk a lot of time and money into this.
Oh,
effort.
Sure.
So
don't worry. You'll get the return.
Yes, thank you. Well, I certainly delightful to speak with you tonight, and I really appreciate your kind words.
You're more than welcome. We are saying goodbye to Brad Buchanan. We are going to be taking a break. I'll be back with you in just a moment, and the phone line is going to be open, and that's 253-582-5597. The Donna Sebo Show is heard weekdays, Monday through Friday, 8 to 9 p.m. Pacific Time. Callers are welcome to call in during the second half of the program at 253-582-5597. Please note that the announcement is made at the bottom of the hour if I'm not in studio able to take phone calls. Warriors for Peace is heard every Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. For current information regarding my email newsletter, programming, and appearances, go to DelphiInternational.com. For information on publications, including my award-winning children's books, audiobooks, and more, go to MrsSebo'sClassics.com. This is Donna Sebo. If you or someone you know is an author and would like to be interviewed on The Donna Sebo Show or Warriors for Peace, please send a copy of the publication along with contact information, phone number, email, and website to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington, 98496. That's The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington, 98496. Please allow 6 to 8 weeks for review. Thank you. Well, who's coming up on tomorrow's show? We're going to be talking with William Hun, Bachelor's Holiday. We're going to be discussing poetry, and I think you will find our conversation one that'll take you on a mind journey that maybe you would not have expected. Then we have a doubleheader, as we always do on Wednesdays. We're going to be talking on the 10th with a gentleman, Michael Cairns. Under the Ash is a phenomenal book. This is a book that is loaded with photographs, and we are going to be talking about Mount St. Helens. He and 14 other National Guardsmen were part of that initial rescue group that went in after the eruption. They actually ended up flying through ash. Their stories are just incredible about that event that took place in 1980. And do you know that lady, Mount St. Helens? She is still, well, every once in a while burping and having a touch of indigestion. So we're just hoping she gets a Pepto-Bismol treatment of some kind or another where that is not going to erupt as before, because those volcanic eruptions really, really do cause quite a bit of damage. So we're going to be talking about that. And then the Donna Sebo Show that follows the Warriors for Peace program is about the Fern, F-E-R-N, Pharmacy. It is absolutely an amazing book. I was so enthralled with it and really astonished at the knowledge that is in this book. So if you know of anybody that's into herbalism or any natural treatments, anything of this nature, don't miss this show. You need to know about this book. It's really good. Then we're going to be talking with Tim Murphy about 7 visualizations. That's going to be on Thursday. And on Friday, it's an open mic hour. So you can call in and chat with me directly. If you'd like to get a reading, you can do that at any time during that hour. And that's this coming Friday. And then we've got a lineup of people during the rest of the month. And yes, there are some spots on the calendar. If you go in to check, you can at any time go into my network page and you'll see a calendar there. And some of the spots on the calendar do not have information yet. That's because I have to wait for confirmations from people relative to having them on the air as a guest. Yes, it takes quite a bit of planning and work to get everything to harmonize. So if you check in on that calendar on my network page, you'll know who's coming up on those days that were not listed in my newsletter. So just know that's a good way to find out who's doing what, when, and where. Also, I wanted to let those of you in Alaska know that I am going to be up in the far north. Yes, I'll be up in Anchorage, Alaska, the first week of October. And that is something that has been put together, pulled together, and I am looking forward to that experience. And remember, the show goes on no matter where I am. So we've got a lineup of people already for the month of October that's beginning to be put together. Don't forget to check out the Author Showcase, where you have those authors who have their shows, their programming, whether it's radio and television or television, then all of that is put up and made available on that link in the Author's Showcase. And we finished the filming last Thursday for episode number 18 for the Donna Sebo television show special editions. And it is about exploring wine regions in Mexico. But, oh, it's so much more than that. So we have the pleasure of having Michael Higgins on that television program. And he just gives so much information and traveling tips, et cetera. It's just absolutely wonderful. Also, I've had people asking me if I do private sessions with people. And the answer is yes, I do. So if this is something you would like to be in touch with me about, all you have to do is call my office, go to my website. You'll find the contact information there. Use the contact page. Oh, and that goes for those of you that may want to be on the television show. And again, the focus is with authors. But if that's something you would like to have an experience with being televised, then you can contact me through the contact page on my website, Delphi International Inc. There's just so much going on. I can never complain about ever being bored. No, 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 no. That's just not in my, what do I want to say, work environment? Mm-hmm. There is so much that I find so interesting. And by the way, if you wanted to give me a buzz, 253-582-5597. Gray hair. I remember many years ago reading about the chemistry of the body that actually creates gray in the hair. There are some people that don't get gray. There are young people whose hair turns totally gray. We've all heard about stories about people that have gone through such trauma and shock that their hair turned totally white within, let's say, 24 hours. This is not a joke. It has happened with a few people. Well, there has been a study by a Japanese university, and it was published in a journal called Antioxidants. And they have found that there is an antioxidant called lutein, L-U-T-E-O-L-I-N. Now, again, that's L-U-T-E-O-L-I-N. Now, this is an antioxidant that's found in many fruits and vegetables, and they say it may help stop or slow hair from turning gray. Now, guess what? They tested this on a mouse. Well, a mouse's chemistry is different from a human being's chemistry. But they use this antioxidant, lutein, both internally and externally. Now, they honestly don't know what the effect will be with people. But again, it all boils down to chemistry. So, they say, if you want, add more of this type of food that contains the lutein, and what are those foods? Your peppers, your green peppers, red peppers, yellow peppers. Interestingly enough, spring onions, radicchio, celery, spinach, broccoli. And then you have oranges, lemons, cantaloupe, kiwis. And there's all kinds of health benefits to these foods, number one, because of the antioxidants that they have. But they say it's also to protection against heart disease. Well, I don't know if this particular antioxidant is in any kind of supplementation. But it is quite interesting how when people will get older, typically their systems will start slowing down. Their digestive processes are different. their activity levels are different. But, you know, there's the Hunza people, and it's very common for them, and they live in a particular geographical area, and they raise their own food, and a lot of their food is fruits and vegetables that they grow. But they also have sometimes fasting periods because they don't have any food to eat. So the food that they have dried during the summer, like their apricots and some other foods, that they can reconstitute. And they're living in a mountainous area where the air is very, very dry. So it's sort of like a freeze-dry process, not unlike what the people in the Andes did with their potatoes and, you know, their other foods. Their foods would not spoil because the temps were so cold. They didn't have a problem with rot like you do in warmer, you know, your tropical environments. I mean, my goodness, I can get bread from, you know, an artisan's type of bread, and if I do not freeze it, if I keep it in the refrigerator even, though that is so alive, mold will develop so quickly, it's not even funny. I mean, I have been astonished, and I live here in the Pacific Northwest, and we're surrounded because of the dampness that we experience. We've got mold in the air all the time. I mean, that is just a part of the environment. So you have that, and it doesn't take much for food to start spoiling. So you either freeze it, or you dry it, or you can it, or if you were interested in smoking it, that might keep mold at bay. But the truth is, this is a real problem for people around the world. How do you keep food stored? And that is why fermentation was able, with your pickling and, you know, with your sauerkraut, all of this that people would put together. The Koreans had kimchi, and they allowed it to ferment in the earth, because that was what you did, or big crocks that it would be put in, so that you had nutritious food during the winter. And, you know, when I think of nutritious food, I'll share this with you. I was on what we called a milk route flight in Alaska one year when I was traveling up there. And I traveled to many different areas in Alaska. But on this one trip, which was from Anchorage to Fairbanks, that normally is a 45-minute trip, well, it ended up being a lot longer than that because the inside of the Alaska Airlines plane literally had all the seats removed, excepting for a very small portion. And there were very few of us passengers on the plane. And the rest of the plane was emptied of the seats so that they could transport cargo, because they were going to areas in Alaska that you could only reach by plane, and they were unloading food and all kinds of things. And I remember how a young couple, they had a new baby. Baby was only like a month old. The mother was on the plane, and I was remembering all of the conversation about her and recalling how difficult it was for them. They had to plan. In Alaska, if you're going to live in any remote areas, they actually give you information on how much to plan on ordering, when you need to order it, so everything could be flown in or brought in, maybe by ship, but many times it was by plane. And Alaska Airlines, that's something that they originated out of Alaska. So there you go. You have all of that. And how they had to have, you know, pallets of food. So they had to be able to haul this stuff up into wherever it was that they were living. And because she had a baby, a new baby, she had to plan on formula and, you know, milk and all kinds of things. And she said it was really something. She had no idea they had to plan that far in advance, but she followed all the directions and was getting everything she needed. Well, up in Alaska, there was a woman that said, for a Christmas gift, and she lived in a remote area with her family. They were very happy doing that. But she did not have an awareness of how important nutrition was, especially during winter. Vitamin C was something that they did not have anything of. They didn't have supplements. They didn't have anything like that. But someone in their family sent them a big batch of preserves, fruit preserves. And she said that got them through their winter. And she realized how important it was to have that for not only cold prevention, but also for the immune system to have the stamina to weather the cold and the sometimes damp conditions that they would experience. Nutrition really is significant, and more research is being done. And sometimes all you need is a trace of something. You don't need buckets of it. You just need a little bit of something. But when you're in a place like the far north, you're not going to have sunshine, so you don't get vitamin D. And you know there's an animal form of vitamin D, not just fish. In fact, some people, the fish vitamin D does not work well with them. It is the animal vitamin D. I learned that, and it made all the difference in the world with me. The fish vitamin D did not give me what my body needed, but the animal vitamin D did. And that comes, I believe, from sheep. Fascinating things that we don't know often. And I learned something new, and I learned that about 10 years ago. So it's really important for us to pay attention. And if it can keep the gray away for a little bit longer, great. Other than that, don't stress yourself out about it. Use hair coloring. Just remember to be wise with the hair coloring. Don't make it look so like everything is one color. It's best sometimes to have a professional do it. And then also yogurt. You know, we're talking about nutrition. Having healthy gut bacteria is extraordinarily important. And yogurt, I remember how I became acquainted with yogurt because of my mentor's mother, who was an excellent cook. She was Lebanese. Now, yogurt is a part of their diet. That's their nationality. It's their environment in the Middle East. Yogurt is a part of their lives, and it's very healthy. And you can make yogurt out of any kind of animal milk, not just cow's milk, but any kind of animal milk. And this is something that enables them to have really good health. It's very, very good, very nutritious. Their breads are very nutritious as well. So sometimes it's good to learn from the other cultures. There's a lot of things we don't know. And the more we can study other cultures and observe what people do, like the Hunza people, yogurt is a part of that. And it is a part of what has made them as a grouping of people. Sometimes people live to be 120, and there was one person recorded that lived to be 160. Of course, they didn't have birth certificates at the time this person was born, but this person knew a lot about history, and they were able to talk about that. So, you know, good health, good food, and we're learning more about how to farm so that we're getting more nutrients in our food, and the farmers are really learning how to do farming in a different way than what we have expected. And why is this happening? Because a lot of areas are finding they're experiencing new kinds of climate change. And so they're asking, what can we do to adapt to this? It's amazing, the resourcefulness of people, what is happening globally around the world, here in the United States, people saying we're going to do things differently because they have learned they can do things in a different way, make it cost effective, and we're going to be able to feed the billions of people that are on this planet. And that is the truth. So don't give up on the resourcefulness, the ingenuity, and the capabilities of human beings to do the adaptations that are necessary. A lot of good things are evolving for all of the bad trash we're getting information about. No, there's a lot of people making a big difference in this world, and they maybe don't get a lot of fanfare, but it is happening. Donna Sebo here. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless. Be well. We are going to be talking again tomorrow. I'm looking forward to it. I hope you'll join me. Tell your friends and family about the show, and don't forget the TV programs. You can always like and subscribe if you so desire. Well, that's it. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.